Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
I will be the first, as soon as I'm authorized, to take the vaccine and give it to my family, absolutely.
Our Walter Isaacson talks to Dr. Moncef Slaoui, the chief scientific advisor to Operation Warp Speed. Then,
we also have to make sure that when the vaccine is distributed, it's accessible to people who've been hurt the most, the brown and black communities.
A pandemic, a presidential election, and historic protests have seen racial inequality come to the fore in 2020. Author and minister Michael Eric Dyson tells me it's been a long time coming. And
my lady Dabambi, why do you sleep so still?
A celebration as Yusuf Cat Stevens re-releases two masterpiece albums on their 50th anniversary. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. As the delivery of COVID vaccines now gathers pace here around the world and in the United States, discussions abound about who should get those precious first doses. Mostly care home residents and staff and the elderly will be at the front of the line. But in their first joint interview, President-elect Joe Biden and his Vice President Kamala Harris emphasized that vulnerable black and brown communities need rapid access as well to this vaccine.
Folks who are African Americans and Latinos are the first ones hurt when something happens, the last ones recover. And you saw the statistics. You know, they're somewhere, depending on which report you get and where you're talking about, from four to five times more likely, three to four times more likely to die if they get COVID. So they need the help and they need to get it in immediately.
And all week we've been updating you on the grim records the United States has been setting in deaths, hospitalizations, and now surpassing 14 million cases. Dr. Moncef Slaoui is the chief scientific advisor to Operation Warp Speed, which is the federal program that helped get the vaccine to the United States market in record time. And here he is talking to our Walter Isaacson about the key issue, safety.
Thank you, Christiane. And Dr. Slaoui, thank you for coming on the show and thank you for all you've been doing.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you know, we've been slammed in the past few weeks with another surge of coronavirus, a person dying every minute. So tell us, next week, next Wednesday, when the FDA committee meets and the Wednesday after that, do you think we're going to get the Pfizer and then the Moderna vaccines?
Well, listen, I hope we will have the approvals very quickly after the meeting. However, it's important to note that the FDA process is totally independent from the operation. And we did that by design to make sure that the independent regulatory body functions appropriately. I am sure that the review that being made is very thorough and very deep. And I'm sure they're doing everything possible to reach a quick conclusion. I expect it to be positive. The data, frankly, are remarkable. You know, what's really powerful is the fact that two vaccines using similar technologies, but actually slightly different, but broadly similar technologies, developed independently, tested independently in two large trials, come up with almost identical outcome on many different levels. To me, is an enormous reassurance that the data are real, are extremely robust, both on the efficacy of the vaccine and on the safety.
And it's particularly interesting because these are vaccines that have never been proven before, which is just sticking messenger RNA in our cells and having our cells produce those spike proteins. That's never been done before, right?
This indeed has never been done as an approved product. There have been many different clinical trials for different diseases using this technology on a few hundred individuals at a time over the last, I would say, at least 4 years or 5 years, but there has never been a product approved. I think now we have experience in 70,000 or so people immunized with this platform technology between the two companies. And really the data are very reassuring in terms of the short and midterm safety of this vaccine. And what we know is the short and midterm safety are predictive of the long-term safety.
So you can tell people, just look right into the camera and say, trust us now. We've tested this. These seem very safe as any other vaccine.
Here's what I say. Every single data I have seen on the toxicology and animal work that assess potential harm and biological reason for harm show that there is none. And it's very similar to other vaccines. All the data I've seen on the safety of the vaccine in the clinical trial shows that the efficacy is outstanding and the safety is similar to that of many other approved vaccines. And all the data I have seen from other vaccines shows that when safety is clear in the first 60 or 90 days after starting immunization, which is one of the reasons the FDA asked for 60 days after completion of immunization, that data is predictive of long-term safety. And it's the case here. That is one part of the equation. I think it's important for us to realize the other part of the equation. Unfortunately, we have more than 2,000 people dying every day, 100,000 people in hospital. Our life has been turned around. We can't work, we can't go to school. Everything is stalled. That's the risk we know. And there is maybe a conceptual risk that one person out of a million may have a problem. It's impossible to predict. The only way to know it is to do it. And in using the vaccine, we will prevent all the harm I just described that we know. And therefore, I will be the first, as soon as I'm authorized, to take the vaccine and give it to my family. Absolutely.
You say that we know the short and medium term. We've already tested it. People like myself have been in trials in 60, 90 days. Is there anything in the science of putting RNA in people's cells that could conceivably make it more dangerous longer term than other type of vaccines?
There really isn't. What people need to understand is RNA is not DNA. DNA, people could conceptually say, oh, it may stick around somewhere and then link to your DNA and do some change. RNA is designed to be destroyed. In fact, a lot of the work that the companies have done, BioNTech or Moderna, has been about protecting that RNA from being instantly destroyed as soon as it gets in our body. When the RNA gets into the cell, it lives for a little bit. It helps as a template to make the antigen, and then it's gone. It's gone from the cell. The cell produces the antigen, spits it out. The immune system itself comes and deals with that cell because they think it's like a virus, and it's all gone. And that's really what the data shows, is that over time, you can't detect the RNA anymore. So it's actually a remarkably fast and effective technology. What happens with these vaccines is we trick our cells to produce exactly the same antigen as if they had the virus in them. And that's very hard to reproduce when we produce vaccines in a big fermenter. And that's really what made this technology so fast and so effective now.
The Pfizer vaccine in particular requires super cold super cold distribution chains, and even the Moderna one does. You're working with the Army. Tell me, how are these things, if next Wednesday and the Wednesday after it gets authorization, how are we going to get it to places like, you know, New Orleans?
So it's really worked out in every single detail over the last several months. We have planned, within the operation, frankly, my co-leader, General Perna, and all the experience of the insights and capabilities of the Department of Defense have planned it to the minute how vaccine doses will be transported from, where they are manufactured to the immunization spot areas that each state will have indicated to us In fact, yesterday with General Perna, we visited UPS Healthcare. UPS would be one of the transportation strategies. UPS delivers millions and millions of parcels every day, everywhere, to every zip code in the U.S., and they will do likewise with the vaccine. FedEx will do the same thing. We also visited some of the warehouses in which the vaccine parcels will be, you know, directed in various direction. Yesterday, also more than 70 different vaccine parcels have been sent empty to test, right, all the system. I think we have worked out with Pfizer and with Moderna the process to deliver this vaccine using what already exists. Every year, 80 million to 100 million doses of influenza vaccine are distributed in the same way, using the same routes, the same transporters, the same warehouses that we're using for this vaccine. So that makes us confident that it should be okay.
But Pfizer just indicated it may have to cut back quite a bit on its first few months of delivery. Why did that happen? And how can we get confidence that this is, you know, after all the testing fiascos we've had, confidence that we can lick this delivery system?
Right. So I frankly don't know exactly what happened, if anything happened at Pfizer. What I know is we have an agreement with Pfizer for receiving a certain number of doses, and those are the number of doses we are receiving here in the USA. I think the issues, if they have happened, have nothing to do with distributing the vaccine. They have to do potentially with manufacturing it. I do want to stress, because I think it's very important to realize that these manufacturing technologies are unbelievably complex and very different than making a phone or a car, because this is engineering. Those vaccines are biology, and biology we don't control as well as engineering. So, and it takes months and months for a batch to go from starting point to actually making sure it has all the quality criteria before you can use it in humans. And we just have industrialized all of that process, and there could be glitches. And I think the best way to deal with that is to be transparent about it if and when it happens, and explain how we recover from it. The good news, frankly, is each batch makes about 1 to 2 million doses. If there is a glitch in one batch, it doesn't change overall. It may change by 2 days the speed with which the population is immunized. At this stage, we have none. We said we will have 40 million doses of vaccine to immunize about 20 million people in the month of December between Pfizer and Moderna vaccine, and that's the plan.
So 20 million in December, how many in January and February? And once we get through February and you give me the number, what percentage of people who want the vaccine will have it then?
So 20 million people fully immunized, two doses in December, 30 million, that means 60 million doses, 30 million people in January, 50 million people in February. That is representing 100 million. The at-risk population is estimated about 120 to 130 million in the U.S. The good news, frankly, is the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and or the AstraZeneca-Oxford vaccine may very well be also approved somewhere in the month of February and start to also participate to add vaccine doses. We can't exactly count on them yet because we need to complete the phase 3 trial and get to the point we are with Pfizer and Moderna, but we may very well have another 10 or 20 million doses to immunize with in February. Definitely by the month of March, all the really susceptible populations in the U.S., the older people, the healthcare workers, the first-line workers, people in long-term care facilities, all these populations would have been immunized if they wanted to be immunized, and we can start immunizing the rest of the population between the month of March and the month of June.
I've got a scientific question, which is these vaccines so far seem very efficient at preventing people from getting COVID if they've been exposed to the coronavirus. Do they also prevent the transmission of the coronavirus by people who might be exposed to it? And is there a difference between the different vaccines as to which ones may allow transmission to occur even if people don't get sick?
It's a very important question from a public health standpoint. And we don't know the answer to it yet in this trial. It's very, very cumbersome to be able to demonstrate it, because what you have to do is you have to swab, because it's virus. In many cases, people are asymptomatic, even though they have the virus. You can't rely on people saying, I don't feel good. Maybe I have, you know, swab or, you know, You have to do swabs every day in people. That's enormously cumbersome. Now that we know that the vaccines work with 95% efficacy, we are designing study in younger population that has high levels of transmission, asymptomatic, to exactly address that question. Now, my prediction is these vaccines are going to be highly effective against transmission, at least shortly after immunization, because you don't get 95% efficacy without quite a remarkably important level of protection. The other thing in the transmission really that's important is what you don't want is people having a lot of virus, what's called virus load. This is what, when somebody has a lot of virus, They transmit a lot of virus to somebody else. That could make that person ill. If somebody has 1,000 times or 10,000 times less virus, they may have detectable virus, but when they transmit it, they transmit, you know, a very little bit of virus, and our body is able to deal with very little bit of virus, less able to deal with a big load of virus. That's my prediction. What's happening is some people will have complete protection against the virus, and some people may have a little bit of virus, but so little that their transmission will be irrelevant.
How do you convince people who are skeptical, including some frontline healthcare workers have expressed skepticism?
Well, I think first we need to reflect, why is there so much hesitancy? And I really think part of that, I personally thought about it in two things have played to enhance or expand the hesitancy. One is people thought that the FDA requirements of saying we need 50% efficacy, as the vaccine will only be 50% effective. The vaccines are 95% effective. That's one. And I think that looks like, okay, now I can have an insurance against this pandemic. The second thing, unfortunately, that happened was there was a lot of political context in which the development happened, exacerbated, frankly, the criticisms and created tension around whether this could happen, whether, you know, corners are cut and this kind of things. And we are where we are today. But what I tell people is transparency is going to be 100%. All the data will be shown, are being shown to the FDA and to the independent committee of experts that the FDA used to advise it. They will be discussed in public. Experts from all over the country will have access to the data that will be published in peer-reviewed journal. And they could even access the raw data on request with the companies. Everything will be on the table. Frankly, what I ask people to do is please keep your mind open. Allow yourself to just hear the data and the information from the experts you trust. There will be a lot of them. And then make up your mind. And I think if we do that, I think many, many people who hesitate now will change their mind.
Did you get yourself insulated from any political involvement where the political appointees might say, rush this one or slow something down?
I asked for that to never happen. And honestly, it never happened. I know that people made talks outside saying the vaccine would be at this time or that time, but that's outside of the operation. Inside the operation, I never had a call, a meeting where I was told do this rather than that or do that rather than this by anybody.
Would you have quit if that had happened?
I would have. And I said it many times. I would have said, I'm out of here.
Have you spoken to or have plans to speak to the Biden transition team and the people like Jeff Zients?
So not yet. I know that there has been an introductory meeting last week. And I know that meetings are planned next week where we will be discussing this.
Would you stay on for a while if Jeff Zients and the new Surgeon General need your advice, or are you committed to leaving in January?
I had set objectives for myself saying once we have two vaccines approved and two medicines approved and in use in the population, it will be time for me to go back to my private life. We're almost there. And therefore, I am considering how I will move out of this role. I will absolutely not do anything that would derail the operation. My affinities are actually high for the new administration, so I have no issue whatsoever helping. But I need to go back to my private life. I'm not compensated for this. I have many other business priorities that I need to deal with. And most importantly, my value add here is going down because we have the vaccines, two are there, two are coming up, the next two are in the pipeline. And I can continue helping from afar, for sure.
Dr. Slaoui, thank you for being with us, and thank you so much for what you've done with Operation Warp Speed.
Thank you for having me.
It really is an amazing scientific feat. And as we mentioned, those vaccines must also reach America's Black and Latino communities, which are being disproportionately hit by coronavirus. The pandemic bookends a year which has seen a moral reckoning emerge over systemic racism in the United States and across the globe, really. A movement that was most recently triggered by the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and too many others. But can this moment lead to actual change? Joining me now to talk about this is academic, author, and minister Michael Eric Dyson. His new book, Long Time Coming, Reckoning with Race in America, explores a troubled history in the form of letters that he wrote to all the people he calls martyrs to the cause of the Black struggle. And he is joining me now from Washington. Welcome to the program, Michael Eric Dyson. I just wanted to ask you to pretty much, let's talk first about what President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, and you just heard Dr. Moncef Slaoui talking about, the most vulnerable communities needing to get it pronto, this vaccine. But of course, in the Black community, there has been historical, injustices, the Tuskegee scientific experiments and, justifiable anger and skepticism. Do you think this is going to play into so many decades later when a vaccine is so much needed by that very community?
I think that, first of all, thanks for having me. I think there is skepticism. There is a kind of wariness in regard to the use of science in regard to Black bodies. Black people are not afraid of science. They are afraid of scientists. They are afraid of the manipulation of data for the purposes that are nefarious or highly questionable, that are unscientific, but using scientific means toward non-scientific ends. There's widespread conspiracy and skepticism in some pockets of Black America, but I think that will be overcome once people begin to see the scientific proof that these vaccines indeed enable and enhance health and not deter them.
And of course, we've heard, the guy who's right there in the interface, the coalface, Dr. Slaoui, who is the scientific advisor, attesting to their safety. And people like President Obama, along with Presidents Clinton and Bush, saying that they would take them publicly on camera and do everything that they could do to help, help people figure out that this is safe. Is that going to be enough? And I actually want to ask you whether other people should do that. You've dedicated the book that we're going to be talking about to LeBron James. So I just wonder whether you think that some of these very popular and well-known and trusted members of the Black community can help here.
I think they can. I think that, yes, it helps to have President Obama take that, vaccine, or Presidents Clinton and Bush, perhaps if famous athletes did so as well. And I hope it's with the recognition that Black people have had legitimate reasons to be skeptical, not enough to prevent them from taking the vaccine. But I think those who are in positions of a power and authority, scientifically or culturally or even politically, should understand that legacy, that it is the legacy of white supremacy through a needle. It's the legacy of white supremacy through a white coat. It's the legacy of white supremacy through the manipulation of scientific rhetoric and discourse to justify the unintelligence of Black people, the inferior capacity to learn of black people, parts of which persist in our own day. When we think about the work of Charles Murray and other people who have tried to legitimate a bell curve suggesting that black people are inherently inferior when it comes to intelligence, must be expanded when we look at the range of sciences that are deployed to either enhance or somehow undercut black people. Having said all that, it does make a difference if some of these famous black people and folk get out there and other trusted figures to suggest, hey, we understand why you have skepticism and wariness, but this thing works. And guess what? The disproportionate impact on black and brown bodies suggests that we need to take this vaccine. And furthermore, we ought to solve not simply the taking of a vaccine, but the lack of access of black and brown people to healthcare organizations that would prevent them from being so vulnerable to it in the first place.
And indeed, what you describe is really grotesque. And I just wonder, in general, about your book, Long Time Coming. You do dedicate it to LeBron James. Tell us why before we get further into it.
Right. Well, I think LeBron James has been exemplary as the most remarkable athlete to put his reputation on the line, to leverage his platform in defense of ordinary black people. He has, not since perhaps Muhammad Ali, has an athlete of his stature, of his global recognition, of his enormous popularity, been willing to leverage all of that in the face of that popularity at the height of his global acclaim in defense of what some would consider to be a controversial subject. That is, that black lives should matter. That shouldn't be controversial, but it remains so in many quarters. And so he's been able to do that and to garner awareness in many pockets of the culture, some of which are sympathetic to black people, others of which may not have been necessarily inclined to do so. So I wanted to celebrate a figure who, in the middle of the Black Lives Matter protests, led basketball players, along with Chris Paul and other figures, to stop their work when Jacob Blake was shot in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and they were saying enough is enough, and we've got to make this point more poignantly.
So it leads perfectly into the substance of your book, Long Time Coming. And you talk about the martyrs. You use that word martyrs, which is a very, very evocative word. And you write this book in the form of letters to individuals who have been killed in this terrible struggle. Tell me about martyrs and the overall message that you are trying to get across.
Right. Well, you know, victims, of course, of police brutality have died for some time who were black. But I think martyrdom is a deliberate choice. And I thank you for emphasizing that, because their lives, through no intent of their own, right? Most martyrs do intend, I will take up a particular issue, I will bear my cross, I will be willing to die, and therefore be martyrs for a cause. These people have been forced to become martyrs. The consequence of their deaths have led to enormous changes of consciousness and galvanizing impetus among African American people. It has also articulated a social imperative to change the structure of society. So in that sense, Emmett Till didn't choose to die at 14 years old, but his death has been used since its grotesque and grim occurrence, its grisly enactment in 1955, as a symbol of social resistance among African American people and the determination to fight back against white supremacy. So are the deaths of Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Rayshard Brooks, and on and on. So I think these figures that I've highlighted in my book, including Breonna Taylor, Sandra Bland, Elijah McClain, George Floyd, and the like, are martyrs because their cause has been taken up. They have been made sacred in the aftermath of their deaths. The posthumous acclaim to which they have been subject, in one sense, enacts a moral utility among black people. What is that moral utility? To express to the culture that their deaths are unwarranted, unjustified, and heinous because they contradict the fundamental principles of justice, truth, and democracy in our culture, and they repudiate the beautiful embrace of all peoples, e pluribus unum, out of many one. So their deaths serve as a warning, as a reminder, and as an encouragement at the same time.
So let's start with the one who, well, the one who you opened the book with, Elijah McClain. Mm-hmm. He was 23 years old, and in 2019, he's a young massage therapist. He's walking back. He's in Colorado, and somebody calls the police saying that he looks sketchy, and it leads to his death. I want you to tell me a little bit about the facts, and then I think you've got a passage that you're going to read for us, a particular passage of your letter to him.
Yes, exactly. first of all, it was horrible. A 23-year-old young man, some say on the spectrum, but a beautiful, sensitive soul who played a violin to pigeons and birds to soothe them, who wouldn't hurt a fly. A young man who one of his coworkers said had a gold orb that sort of surrounded him as he walked and as he came to work. This was extraordinarily painful because that sweet soul was crushed into nothingness by the brutal force of a police contingent that disregarded his request, please respect my boundaries that I'm speaking, and they did not. They indeed hugged him so closely that they didn't asphyxiate him, but they did knock him out. They did put a chokehold on him that rendered him unconscious twice. And then when the EMT showed up, ketamine was administered. The man went into shock. A week later, after being taken to the hospital, he died. This was an enormous tragedy that didn't get the kind of acclaim it would have ordinarily received, perhaps, had there not been other news to block it out. But with the death of George Floyd, it was revived in the itinerary and agenda of Black freedom because his death became exemplary of the kind of hostilities to which Black people are subject when they encounter the police.
Would you read a little bit of the passage?
Yes. Elijah, you showed you were a sensitive and lovely soul. You did this despite enduring bouts of crying and vomiting. Elijah, you too, like Eric Garner and George Floyd, said, I can't breathe. You told them, I'm just different. That's all. I'm so sorry. You told them, I have no gun. I don't do that stuff. You promised, I don't do any fighting. Then you pleaded, why are you attacking me? I don't even kill flies. I don't eat meat. As if your penchant for peacefulness and your dietary discipline might somehow convince them that your life was worth sparing.
It's really heartbreaking. And I want to ask you specifically, because you address this book to white people as well. You talk directly to white people saying, my fellow Americans, I beg of you, first consider this. Do you realize how weary I am, how weary we are, millions of Black folks in this country? And right from the start, it's a troubled we, a complicated we, a disputed we of being denied recognition as Americans or even as human beings. I guess it's massively important that white people hear this. And we've heard, you know, President-elect Biden say to the Black community, when I needed you, you had my back. Now I'm going to have your backs. Right. Do you think now, finally, a change is on the way?
Yes, I think so. And that's a nice tag to Long Time Coming, the name of the book, A Change Is Going to Come, is the Sam Cooke song from which that title is derived. So I knew that Christian Amanpour was a remarkably brilliant journalist as a musicologist as well is beautiful to know. Yes, I think that finally America will begin to grapple with some of the persistent bigotries, the plagues with which Black people have been cursed that have to be addressed, that have to be dealt with. I think that finally many white brothers and sisters woke up. And we can be in harsh judgment of them. My God, did it take George Floyd's death? Did you not see slavery? Did you not see Jim Crow? Did you not see the civil rights struggle, the Black freedom struggle? Did you not see white water fountains and Black water fountains or Brown versus Board of Education? I'm not interested in that. What I'm interested in is that now that people are awake, what can we do? Now that people are sensitive to the call and claim of Black liberation, of emancipation, of resistance to being demonized and marginalized in the culture, of the insistence, we don't want any more than anybody else, but we want what everyone else ostensibly and theoretically receives, recognition as a human, the decency of their own identity, the bodies to be protected and served by the police and not to be harmed. I think that this is a pregnant moment to begin to engage in that long conversation, that long overdue dialogue that we need to have in order to transfer the ideals of the Declaration of Independence, to march them from parchment to pavement, and to make sure that they are not interned in ink, but that they are let loose upon the American culture for which they were meant. And so in that sense, I think we do have the opportunity to make a difference, to challenge some of the madness that has been going on, and that perhaps together we can begin to realize some of the noble ambitions of the democracy that all of us have invested in.
A rallying cry for our time. Michael Eric Dyson, thank you so much for joining us. And now we take an electrifying stroll down memory lane with singer-songwriter Yusuf Cat Stevens. He shot to stardom 50 years ago with music and lyrics that were full of poetry, spirituality and great beats, of course. Tea for the Tillerman from 1970 has been called a masterpiece, and Monobone Jackon also that year featured the haunting track Lady Darbanville. Here's a vintage clip which was unearthed and released for the first time just this week.
My Lady Darbanville, why does it grieve me so? But your heart seems so silent. Why do you breathe so low? Why do you breathe so low? My Lady Darbanville, why do you sleep so still? I'll wake you tomorrow, and you will be my fill. Yes, you will be my fill.
Now to mark half a century since both hit albums, Yusuf is not just re-releasing, but reimagining them as well. Indeed, over this past half century, the artist has also reimagined himself to an extent, as we discussed when he joined me from home in Dubai. Yusuf Cat Stevens, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
So tell me about the 50th anniversary re-release and reimagining of your classic Tea for the Tillerman. What was the objective?
Well, you know, after 50 years, where have they gone? You know, that's the first question. But after 50 years, you gather a lot of experience, and you know, and you've learned a lot. You've gathered a lot of ideas, and of course, I've been through many, many changes, some of which we'll probably talk about today. But you know, it was the 50th was coming up. My son, you know, who's kind of prods me whenever things, you know, need to be done. He said, well, what are we going to do? And he said, what about, why don't we re-record it? And I said, that's a good idea. You know, I love a challenge. And that was the idea behind it. And really just to kind of pay tribute really to this very important album, which a lot of people couldn't recognize me for this album more than any other.
Well, I mean, Father and Son is a classic. Every son, every father can relate to these words and to this notion. So I'm going to play just a clip of the reimagined version on Tea for the Tillerman 2.
Take your time, think a lot. Think of everything you've got. You will still be here tomorrow, but your dreams may not. How can I try to explain? 'Cause when I do, he turns away again. It's always been the same, same old story.
It's pretty amazing because you are now at you know, 50 years plus singing The Father, and your young self of 50 years ago is singing The Son as you did back then. It's a remarkable new way of telling this story.
It is. I mean, I'm afraid that I continue to take the son's side, whatever part I'm, you know, even when I'm singing the father's, to be honest, I'm waiting to get into the son because I was into change. I was into experimentation and exploring. And I think that the son represents that, You know, the actual origin of this song, was, I've got to tell you, was originally because I was trying to write a musical. And I'd chosen the Russian Revolution. Well, like, you know, something quite easy to do. But so when it came to this story, it was a story of a basically two families. One was the Alexander and Nicholas, you know, they were Tsar and Tsaress. And then you've got this little family in the countryside, and the son wanted to join the revolution. And the father just said, no, you know, you just stay here. Everything's fine. You know, we can work this out. And so this song was quite revolutionary in its background and its intent, but it hits all sorts of levels. I mean, you know, the family is always the most important, you know, relationship we ever have. It's our parents, it's our children, it's our, you know, brothers and sisters. And so it really strikes a chord. It continues to.
And, you know, your lyrics have been described as poetic, spiritual. Some have said that it even, you know, belied your very, very young years. I mean, you were, I think, 22 when you started having and doing these amazing hits. And as you say, they have actually stood the test of time. But the father, son, and the revolution, I just want to ask you, does it have any personal resonance? Was your father against you becoming, you know, a singer, a pop star at that time?
No, he bought my first guitar. I mean, he was great. Dad gave me all the freedom I needed. I mean, he was a journeyer himself. He was an adventurist. You know, he left Cyprus, he went to Egypt, married, you know, had children, and then went on to America, you know, during the Roaring 20s. Can you imagine? So, you know, then he came back through to UK, and by that time he'd sort of separated from his first wife, and he met my mother. And so, you know, he was an adventurer, and I think I've taken on a lot of those characteristics, obviously.
You talk a lot about transitions, and your life story is, you know, I mean, it's like 12 different lives packed into one span of time. It's extraordinary, including a very serious brush with tuberculosis. And that, I think, was a turning point moment for you where you could tell me about it. How old were you, and what did that mean in your sort of, you know, timeline of being a singer?
Well, it was like I'd had, in a way, I was very, very lucky because my first song, my first record, you know, it was a hit called I Love My Dog back in 1966. But then, of course, I had to get into the, I was doing the business. I was doing everything that they were telling me, working, you know, three shows a night, really struggling, and, you know, playing with Jimi Hendrix, all that stuff. It compounded, obviously. And eventually I became sick. I couldn't take it. And my body said, no, I contracted tuberculosis. And then suddenly I had to go back to sort of square one. And it was just me in the hospital, you know, kind of reviewing my life and thinking about the future. And I had a book with me about Buddhism. And that was the key, really, to my journey. The first steps I took on the spiritual journey was because I read this book about Buddhism. And, you know, I was a Christian. I was having, you know, a very strong Christian background in a way where there was a school, you know, not dad and mum, it was the school. They really drilled it into me. But and then sort of I went on this journey and I started to make my own music again. But this time my music was mine. I decided to take control. And I was very fortunate again to meet somebody who really believed in me, Chris Blackwell, who, you know, ran the Island Records label. And he heard Father and Son, and he just wanted to sign me up. And then, you know, that's where my second career began. And that's when a lot of people in America got to know me. And to a point where everybody almost thinks I'm American. You know, that was just so big.
We're going to play another clip from Hard-Headed Woman. It's also on Tea for the Tiller Man, but this is the original. But let's just play it.
I'm looking for a hard-headed woman. One who will take me for myself. And if I find my hard-headed woman, I won't need nobody else, no.
reasons why I actually wanted to play that is because for me, it's amazing to hear you as a man singing that you want a hard-headed woman. I haven't actually encountered many of those. Is that real? Did you really want a hard-headed woman to make you do your best as you sing?
Well, if you think about marriage as a partnership, or, you know, the woman who comes into your life has to have a strong personality. I mean, to, you know, to deal with me, you've got to have a strong personality. It's probably everybody says the same thing, but, you know, it definitely means that I want somebody who can keep me going in the right way. And that was, you know, until when I wrote that song, I didn't really know who I was looking for, but I knew that it was somebody who was going to be kind of backbone for me. And, you know, when it comes to the differences between, you know, all this, you know, there's no war between male or female. It's just, but, you know, you've got to have a mind. And these days, you know, we're seeing that this is, I mean, almost every other song in the hit parade, most of them songs are, you know, ladies. I mean, you're dominating this whole thing now. it's gone crazy. I think I'll retract that song now.
No, you won't, because we're just leveling the playing field and taking nothing away from you. But I want to talk to you a little bit about your different journeys and actually identities. And one way to do that is to just ask you about, you know, you have gone through quite a few names. You grew up as Stephen Dimitri Georgiou. Professionally, of course, you were Cat Stevens. You converted and you became Yusuf Islam. And now we call you Yusuf Cat Stevens. Tell me about what was it like growing up in England at that time, being a Greek Cypriot and having a name like that? Did you encounter any pushback or even bullying or anything at school?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Stephen Dimitri Georgiou was not going to get you very far, to be honest, with the guys. You know, that they took the mickey, obviously, and things like that. But my dad had a restaurant, so I had a kind of an up on them, and so that gave me a little bit of a stature. And I think that if you look at, you know, why did I want to start making music? Because there was something within me that was not being recognized, because I was maybe looked at as like this or like that. And I was trying to find out who I was, because my father was from Cyprus, my mother from Sweden. We were born, you know, born in London. You know, we were living in above a shop with a French-sounding name, you know, Moulin Rouge. I mean, so I had to make sense of this, and that was a big, I would say, propulsion in my life is to go and find out who I was. That means sometimes you change your name. You know, like first I was a son. You know, a brother. I'm also, you know, now I'm a daddy, I'm a granddaddy. So we have different names as we go through life, but I definitely made some sharp turnings, you know, you can say that.
And you were a Christian and you became fascinated by Buddhism and then you converted to Islam. What was the moment that led you to that?
Well, I mean, I don't know if many of the viewers know the story, but, you know, essentially it was, I'd kind of reached the top, the summit of you know, of stardom and everything, superstardom, you can call it. And everything was kind of coasting, but I wasn't really happy and I was still, you know, desperately empty inside. I needed something. And I went, one day I went for a swim. It was kind of, I think, 1975, and it was in Malibu. And it was not a very good time to go swimming. And anyway, I did. And then I started to try and swim back. Course, that wasn't going to happen. Suddenly, I realized there was very few moments left of my life. At that moment, I used that time just to call out to God. And I said, God, if you save me, I'll work for you. That was it. And then a little wave came from behind me. I can't describe how it was, what happened exactly, but then I was able to get back to land. This wave had pushed me, and suddenly I had the energy. I was back. That was the turning point. I'd made a promise. After that, my brother visited Jerusalem. He was married to an Israeli girl, and he was having his honeymoon. And then he saw And then he discovered Islam in the middle of Jerusalem. He found this dome, you know, and he wanted to know more. When he came back to London and we met there, he gave me a birthday present. It was the Quran. And that's the first time I ever even thought about Islam, because it was kind of slightly repulsive to me because my father's Greek, you know, and all the things that we grow up with, you know, Ali and the 40 thieves and all that stuff, you know, you don't really trust them, do you? So I had to get past a lot of, you know, barricades. But when I had this book, I thought, this book's not going to hurt me. You know, it's a book. So I started reading the book, and that was it. I just discovered that they, you know, Muslims believe in God and all the prophets and then the Day of Judgment and goodness and so many things that that I knew already was, you know, intrinsically in my body and my soul. And it came to the point where I realized that was the promise I made, and I fulfilled it, God willing.
One of the things that clearly saddened your fans was, having found that, you also decided to not perform anymore. And I think famously, you either gave away or sold. Anyway, you got rid of your huge collection of guitars and you stopped performing. Why did you, well, I guess, what made you come back to it after all that time?
Well, you know, I did go through a whole period, of course. I mean, I was so happy to have found who I was. You know, Joseph, by the way, was always my favorite name. And Joseph was a chapter in the Quran, which really opened my heart. So, but when I came to sort of living the life of a Muslim, that was fine until things started going wrong in the world. And, you know, I didn't have anything to do with it. But unfortunately, I was a bit famous and I was like a Muslim who was kind of easy to kind of, oh, well, let's ask him, you know. And so then I get involved in all this stuff. When it came to, I think there was a moment, I gave my music up because I had so many other things I was doing. I was married and I had my family and I was in education and philanthropy and, you know, relief, you know. But then came Bosnia. And when Bosnia happened, it was a wake-up call, because it was the disaster that I couldn't believe and that was happening, and the world was not doing anything about it. And I saw these people, and they were still singing. And it just struck me so hard that we need music. We really do. When we have nothing else, you know, and we have still the chance to raise our spirits with a song, you've got to do it. And that's kind of was the beginning of my journey back to music.
It's very resonant for me, because for myself and my generation of journalists, Bosnia was a defining moment as well. And I just wonder whether now, are you back? Are you going to be performing? Are you going to continue? Or is this a one-off for the 50th anniversary?
Well, no, I've got so much going on. I've got, you know, by the way, I'm writing my autobiography, so get ready, you know. And plus, I was recording already, I'd finished more or less another album, about 11 songs, new songs, and then came the 50th. And then my son said, we've got to do something. So then that diverted us into, you know, making Tea for the Tillerman 2. So that's where that was. But now I've still got another album ready to go. And that will be released probably next year sometime. And there's some beautiful songs. I mean, you know, I was given the gift, to, you know, to be able to keep on writing and keep on singing. People, when they hear my voice, they say, wow, how did you do that? You know, how come you don't sound different? And, well, of course, I don't drink and I smoke and all that stuff. But anyway.
Now, can I dare to ask you whether you have a guitar at hand or a keyboard, and whether you would play a couple of notes for us?
But I don't know what you want me to sing. Hang on.
Well, Wild World, or Father and Son, or whatever you want.
This is really impromptu. Let's tune it up a little bit. Told you it wasn't my favorite guitar. I listen to the wind of my soul.
Where I'll end up, well, I think only God really knows. I've sat upon the setting sun, but never, 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 I never wanted water once. No, never, never, never. There you are. For you.
Wow. Oh, wow. That is so perfect. Thank you so much. What a gift.
God bless you, my dear. And let's hope we meet again.
Let's hope.
Aww. Yusuf Cat-Stevens still got it. And that was The Wind from his 1971 album, Teaser and the Firecap. And the Yusuf Cat-Stevens celebration continues this weekend as 40 artists cover his work at the virtual festival, Cat Song. And finally, we want to recognize some of this year's most essential workers. This year's winner of the $1 million Global Teacher Award is truly inspiring. When Ranjit Desali arrived to teach at a primary girls' school in a small village in western India, attendance was very low, and the curriculum wasn't even in the students' local language. So he learned that language, translated materials, and developed special digital learning tools as well. And they are now used across India. Now, at Ranjit School, no one misses a class. Yup, that is it for now. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.